Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye.
The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Good morning. We have four cases. Is that right? Yeah, four to hear this morning. Counsel, we're familiar with your cases. We've read your briefs, the authority cited in your briefs, at least portions of the record. You have limited time this morning, so feel free to get straight to the heart of your argument. We're probably going to have some questions if we do. And the red light is shining. You're on our time as long as you're just answering a question, and you won't lose rebuttal time. But do be mindful of our time and when the red light shines. Otherwise, you need to wrap it up. And I mean really wrap it up. Our first case this morning is Green Rock versus Internal Revenue Service. Yes, Mr. Klimas.
May it please the court, Jeff Klimas for the United States. The text, structure, and history of Section 6707 Cap A of the Internal Revenue Code demonstrate Congress's clear intent to endorse and ratify an existing regulation that authorized the IRS to identify listed transactions by notice and not using notice and comment rulemaking. In holding to the contrary, the district court erred. We start with the statutory text, and we think the most relevant text, the most specific text on point, is in 6707 Cap A C1. The two clauses that we think are most relevant are as determined under regulations prescribed under Section 6011, and such transaction is of a type which the Secretary determines as having a potential for tax avoidance or evasion. That second clause uses the word determines in present tense. The Secretary determines, and that is made subject to the preceding clause that refers to as determined under regulations prescribed under Section 6011.
But so where in that does it meet sort of a clear statement about procedure? I guess that's what we're here for, is not whether, for example, the Secretary can in fact do these things and identify listed transactions and whatnot, but the procedure. And so that's what I'm having trouble with is where do I get an exception to the APA in that language?
Yes, Your Honor. So when the Secretary is being directed to we think use a particular procedure, because it's saying the Secretary makes its determination, that's the second clause, as determined under regulations prescribed under Section 6011. We think that what Congress was doing was endorsing and ratifying the existing procedure that appeared in the Treasury regulation, the -4 regulation. And so what we think, and that clearly spells out a procedure that is different than the APA, or at least gives the option of using a procedure that is different than the APA, because it refers to identification by notice, regulation, or other published guidance. And a notice is something different than something that appears in the Federal Register or goes through notice and comment rulemaking.
You don't need magic words, right? The courts have said you don't need magic words to supersede or override the APA's usual notice and comment requirements. But Section 559 of the APA does use the word expressly. How do we give some meaning to that word?
Yes, Your Honor.
In this context.
Yes, Your Honor. And certainly when it says expressly, the Supreme Court in Dorsey said that can mean by clear implication, by necessary implication, by fair implication. And we think that where there is congressional awareness, both presumed and actual, of the existing Treasury regulation, and Congress did not override it either in enacting 6707 Cap A or the companion provisions extending the statute of limitations and dealing with suspension of interest rules, and subsequently legislated on top of that without overriding the existing Treasury regulation. That serves as persuasive evidence. That's what the Supreme Court said in Boeing.
And it doesn't matter how far the commissioner goes in expanding its regulatory, the IRS's regulatory authority going forward. Like once, if we determine that this is the sort of statute that expressly allows the superseding of the APA's notice and comments requirements, then what are the limits on the commissioner's substantive authority going forward?
Yes, Your Honor. We think that the commissioner's authority is circumscribed both by the text of the statute and by the text of the regulation. And if the secretary were to do something to amend that regulation or change that regulation, it would have to go through notice and comment rulemaking.
So your position, that, just so I understand it, your position is that this statute locks in the pre-existing regulation, but that you could change it by going through notice and comment to change the pre-existing regulation?
Hypothetically, I mean, that would be a much harder case.
I guess I'm just having trouble with that because it seems like if the statute, if your position is that when Congress adopted the statute, it sort of locked in and statutorily approved of the existing way that the IRS was doing things, then how could the IRS ever change how it does things, right?
We wouldn't have an argument that Congress had endorsed or ratified the existing regulation anymore. That if the IRS, if Treasury, for whatever reason, promulgated a different regulation and changed that procedure, I think we'd have a much more uphill battle than we do here, where we're saying that in 2004, Congress was aware of, both presumed to be aware of, and actually aware of that existing regulation that determined process. And so we are of the position that locks it in. Whether or not Treasury could change that process, I don't know. But I think that would be consistent with the statutory language that talks about the Secretary's determination, present tense, being made as determined under regulations prescribed under Section 6011.
Can I ask you a sort of weird hypothetical on this timing issue? So let's say we agree with you on how all of the statutes work together and what they mean. New commissioner of the IRS comes in, eliminates the rule that we're talking about today substantively, right? Just eliminates it, gets rid of it, doesn't like it. New commissioner comes in 4 years later, wants to go back to the old rule. Is notice and comment required?
Yes, Your Honor. Procedurally, to withdraw the regulation in the first instance, since the regulation went through notice and comment rulemaking, you need notice and comment to withdraw or rescind it. And then if you were to...
No, I'm talking about the one that didn't go through notice and comment rulemaking here.
I'm sorry, what regulation didn't go through notice and comment rulemaking?
Well, the listed transactions.
The listed transactions
right.
Didn't go through
here. What we're substantively debating here, not procedurally okay. Debating, if the commissioner, the new commissioner, gets rid of it, and since it didn't go through notice and comment in the first place, I would think it doesn't have to go through notice and comment in the second place to get rid of it, right?
Certainly. So the listed transaction notices themselves could be withdrawn without going through notice and comment. Absolutely.
New commissioner comes in, wants to reimpose them. Now what? Notice and comment required or not?
Not for the listed transaction notices, because the government's position is that those are authorized by the regulation to be issued by notice, regulation, or other published guidance. And since notices don't go through notice and comment rulemaking.
So you have to check the substance of what existed at the time?
So it's our position that...
That statute that you says enables this was there?
So the IRS, it's our position, has the authority to identify new listed transactions today using notices. That is our position, and can do that without using notice and comment rulemaking. That's consistent with what the statute and the regulation provide.
Just as a matter of general administrative law, why wouldn't the IRS go through notice and comment? The APA provides limited exceptions for doing things on a sort of emergency basis without the ability to immediately do notice and comment and then do notice and comment right afterwards. Why shouldn't that scheme be followed by the commissioner in this circumstance?
So, Your Honor, we think that the answer is that it is important for the IRS to be able to move swiftly in this area because of the way that...
Say that again?
We believe it is important for the IRS to be able to move swiftly in this area because of the way that tax shelter promotion works. If you look at, for example, the Interior Glass case, right, you had a shelter promoter who marketed a tax strategy to a customer, was not a listed transaction at the time. The IRS subsequently identifies it as a listed transaction, and he gets a phone call from his promoter saying, in effect, good news, bad news. The bad news is that the IRS has identified the transaction that we engaged in as a listed transaction. You now have to affirmatively report it, and we have to get you in compliance with your reporting obligations. The good news is I've already come up with a variation on that strategy that doesn't have to be reported. We're going to get you into that strategy now. It's important to understand what was going on in the late 1990s and early 2000s as a backdrop of this. I don't want to sound hyperbolic, but that's the height of the tax shelter craze. And what was at stake was, in a sense, whether the income tax system was going to become voluntary for high-income taxpayers. That's the sense you get when you read the dissent from Judge Nega in Green Valley. That's the sense you get from the tax court's opinion in Black Investments that we cite in our opening brief, where they're talking about the proliferation of tax shelters. There are more shelters, more complicated tax shelters, more participants in tax shelters, more dollars being invested in tax shelters. And if you look at the Son of Boss tax shelter that was at issue in Black Investments, the tax court is citing to a statement from the House Ways and Means Committee chairman and ranking member, where it talks about participation in the Son of Boss tax shelter being an act of sheer defiance and disregard for the tax laws of the United States. There was a sense that they had to move quickly because the statute of limitations was about to run on many of these transactions, and those dollars, those revenue, would be lost forever. That's why their 6707 Cap A is accompanied by these other provisions, including 6501C10, which says that if you don't report a listed transaction, the statute of limitations does not begin to run. It was important for the IRS to be able to move quickly and to identify these things quickly just because of the pace at which these things were happening and the pace at which things were changing and the fact that the statute of limitations were going to be running on these transactions if these things were not issued quickly.
Can I ask you a numbers question?
Yes, sir.
And if you need to look, come back on rebuttal to tell me about this, I would appreciate it. The service has identified by my count 36 listed transactions, 28 through revenue notice, others through revenue ruling. Is that right?
That sounds right. I don't know the exact number, but it's roughly whether it's 32 or 36. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. The recognized abusive and listed transactions from the IRS. If you go to the web, there's 34 active listed transactions and 2 delisted transactions. Does that sound right?
That sounds right, Your Honor.
Okay.
Can you address this for me? So if I understand correct, the tax court has held that this should be done via regulation. Am I right about that?
That's correct, in Green Valley.
Yeah, I guess,
the Sixth Circuit, too.
Right, yeah, but I guess you are subject, and by you, I don't mean you, personally, but the IRS goes to the tax court all the time, and I think you would have to go through the tax court to effectuate any of these penalties. Does the tax court ruling, does that sort of dispose of this issue for all practical purpose? Or how is this ruling going to have practical effect one way or the other?
Yes, Your Honor. So there's different ways that someone could get into court. So, for example, this suit is brought directly under the APA, and it's not challenging any penalties.
Right, absolutely.
So it wouldn't have to run through the tax court at all.
But if you actually wanted to get money from them for failing to comply with this, you would have, it wouldn't be this lawsuit, it'd be something else, right?
Sure, so 6707 Cap A penalties are imposed without regard to whether there's a tax deficiency, so those actually have to be challenged via refund suit in district court and not in the tax court, so that'd be another avenue in which you'd end up in district court rather than in the tax court. And then I would finally note that the tax court decision, the tax court treats its own published decisions as being binding on itself, but they are appealable to whatever circuit the taxpayer typically resides in. So Green Valley, I think, would be appealable to the Fourth Circuit. We would see what happens.
Right. Yeah, has that happened, I guess? I'm trying to figure out whether that's...
The case, I think there are still other outstanding issues in the case, so it's not final and appealable at this point.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's hear from Mr. Norris. You've saved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Norris, before you get too far into it, one thing. I suspect this case isn't moot, but I wanted to make sure it's not. My understanding is your client's no longer in the business of these syndicated commercial easements and conservation easements, and Congress has effectively eliminated this deduction. And I was just wondering... And your client, as I understand it, has always complied with the reporting requirements. Can you remind me why this isn't, why the underlying controversy is not moot?
Yes, Chief Judge Pryor, it's the same reason that Judge Axson gave, which is my client last was a material advisor on one of these transactions in 2022, is also a party to some of those transactions. And so the record keeping requirements of the notice are in effect for 7 years. So my client still has burdens under the notice for until 2029.
Well, that's what Judge Brasher told me, so that sounds right.
Also, to Judge Brasher's point, the tax court not only has rejected my friend's position, that decision was 15-2 in favor of our position.
Well, they have a lot of judges on the tax court. I was not aware of that
either. I think that's with three vacancies, too. I mean, okay. I'm not sure what, exactly. So in the Sixth Circuit, 3-0 also rejected my friend's view. I think that's the right answer. The American Jobs Creation Act of 2004 does not expressly exempt the IRS from notice and comment. Subsection C1, which my friend has been referencing, just defines what a reportable transaction is. It says that it's something that the secretary determines poses a risk of tax avoidance. To quote Judge Sutton, the statute addresses a which transactions question, not a what process question. Though it does mention regulations in C1, it's at best silent about the process that those regulations have to go through. It doesn't mention the APA.
If Congress is going to exempt the agency from notice and comment, it has to do so expressly. It is the right test to ask whether the procedures that Congress has approved are so clearly different from those required by the APA that it must have intended to displace the notice and comment requirements.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's roughly paraphrasing what Justice Scalia said in his concurrence in Lockhart. This is basically the presumption against implied repeal, which is very powerful, and says it has to either be impossible to comply with both the APA and the new process, or the new process has to have utterly displaced the APA in a way that it makes it clear that Congress couldn't have meant for the APA to govern. Judge Jordan, you mentioned the magic words language from Marcello from the Supreme Court. It's important to remember why the Supreme Court said that. That was a case where, for deportation proceedings, Congress had mirrored every single provision of the APA, except in sometimes it would deviate from the APA or adopt different procedures than the APA. And then it had a provision that said, these procedures for deportation proceedings are the sole and exclusive procedures to be used. Then the court, at that point, the court said, okay, if you need more than that, then this is really a magic words requirement. But you have to be express. It is a words requirement, and in fact, it's a clear words requirement, and that's just missing from this statute. Just want to make a couple of additional points on that. You know, the statute says under regulations, that's what C1, my friend's favorite language, says under regulations. Under regulations is a really weird way to say that the IRS does not need to use regulations. I don't see that anywhere in that language. I think the IRS would have used much different language if it meant to incorporate an existing IRS regulation, such as incorporating the existing IRS regulation, or even using the language of the IRS regulation would have been an improvement. If my friend is right, it could have said, quote, regulation, notice, or other published guidance. That's the key procedural language from the regulation. That appears nowhere in the statute. I'd point you to Judge Toro's concurrence in the Green Valley case for the tax court. He pointed out that we're actually talking about listed transactions here, not reportable transactions. The language my friend likes is in the reportable transactions definition. C2 defines listed transactions. It actually is cuts and pastes from the regulation that my friend likes and says, listed transaction, it adopts the exact same definition, except it cuts off the part of the regulation that talks about process. So it stops when the regulation goes on to say by notice, regulation, or other published guidance, which Judge Toro, I think, rightfully pointed out, is some indication that Congress did not mean to ratify at least the procedural aspect of the IRS's regulation.
Well, it's at best silence.
It's at best silence.
And it's the expressly requirement then comes into play. Did I have numbers right earlier about the list of transactions? And it seems like 28 of the 34 existing listed transactions were not backed by statutory penalties at the time of their issuance. And you heard my numbers earlier about there are 28 were through revenue notice, others through revenue ruling, 34 active listed transactions, 2 delisted, Does that sound right to you?
That sounds right, Your Honor. I think that hits on an important point. I think my friend's strongest argument is the notion that if Congress had agreed with us, then in 2004, when it passed the AJCA, it would have invalidated all of those listed transactions. But I don't think that's true. The tax court has explained this in the Seabrook case, which my friend cites, I believe, in footnote 3 of the blue brief. And it says, before the AJCA, you could consider all of those notices to be interpretive rules that are not even subject to notice and comment because they had no penalties. The AJCA changed everything. It introduced severe monetary penalties for not following the reportable transaction regime. And so what Congress likely meant is going forward, the IRS needs to use notice and comment. That's a really important distinction. And so that's actually a reason why.
It's those penalties and criminal sanctions that rendered the listing notice a legislative rule.
Correct. And my friend concedes it's a legislative rule now. And I don't think he actually has a theory for saving those old notices either. Unless I'm right that those were interpretive rules before 2004, they would have been invalid under my friend's theory because he thinks the only reason that they're exempt from the APA is because of a 2004 statute, but those regulations all predate that 2004 statute.
On your side of the case, even though you may not need this to prevail if we accept your arguments, is the Sixth Circuit opinion it, or do the concurrences in the tax court parse the issue out in a better way?
I think I prefer the Sixth Circuit's analysis. I mean, I prefer to win, so either one would be okay. But the Sixth Circuit's analysis, I think, is correct and simple. There's nothing expressed in the statute. It has to be expressed. They called my friend's argument potential inferences layered on top of conjectural implications when you're talking about this ratification theory. I think that just does not qualify as an argument that can succeed to defeat the APA. But I actually think the concurrences in the tax court make a lot of really good additional points. Four of those judges actually agreed that what Congress was doing was ratifying that regulation that my friend cites, and still the IRS loses under this argument. And that's because that regulation says not just, you know, the IRS can identify things through guidance. It says notice or regulation. Regulation is also in that regulation. That's a method that the IRS had identified. So what Congress could have been doing is saying, yes, we're ratifying that process, but what we mean is you need to use regulations when the APA requires you to use regulations, and you can use notices when the APA does not require regulations. So for example, you could use a notice if what you're doing is just an interpretive rule, if it's just a real small clarification of an existing legal position of the IRS. Yeah. Or you could use notice without notice and comment when you have a good cause, you have the good cause exception satisfied, when you have to go really, really fast. Judge Pugh's concurrence in the tax court actually gives an example from that era where the IRS had used the good cause exception. There's something called the son of boss transaction where they used good cause to get out temporary regs really fast. So that was something that Congress would have been aware of.
Yeah, can I give you another just hypothetical that came up with opposing counsel's argument? See if you agree with me on this. So he raised the issue of, you know, the IRS goes through all this trouble to have a regulation that identifies a transaction that is a serious problem, and then the tax advisor calls and says, hey, I've got a tweak on this. That means we don't have to report it anymore. Wouldn't that be a situation where the IRS could use a notice and say, look, we've already got a regulation that defines this as a listed transaction or something else like that. You know, we hear that there's this tweak on it going around, issue a notice and say, you know, we see this as the same thing as what we've already said you can't do. Would that be a situation where you could use a notice?
So the short answer is yes. If the IRS had already identified a listed transaction through notice and comment, and then there was a tweak, I do think that's arguably, they have a pretty good argument that that's an interpretive rule. Mm-hmm. But also the statutory scheme here also has the words like substantially similar is throughout this regime. And so it already sort of covers those types of things. You can't actually just make minor tweaks and get away with it.
Yeah.
But the other point about sort of the policy implications here, I don't think my friend's policy arguments about the need to go really fast to identify these abusive shelters are, I don't think they matter because you need express statements in the text. And no amount of policy arguments can put words in there that Congress didn't use. But if we're going to have a policy debate, I think we would win it. Notice and comment is good. It's a good thing. And the IRS does.
Is the IRS putting these notices through notice and comment now?
It has started to. So I Googled this a couple of days ago. I found about four listed transactions for which there are NPRMs now. So they've started the process. Those include our case. So there's an NPRM governing the exact transactions in Notice 1710. And it proves my point. It's not going to bog the IRS down that much. Comments only have to be open for about 30 to 60 days. That's all the IRS has to wait. And all it has to do then, it can choose almost any policy option it wants to. It just has to reasonably consider the issues and reasonably respond to the comments. The thing that I think is missing from my friend's brief is, it is a big deal to call something a listed transaction. It has a huge effect on that industry. It basically freezes up investors. It calls an entire industry tax scammers. It really puts a sort of a scarlet letter on an entire business transaction. And then it subjects everyone who's in that business, legitimate or illegitimate, to onerous record keeping and reporting requirements on threat of, you know, monetary penalties and criminal liability. It's a big, big deal. I think the least the IRS can do is hear from the people who are doing those transactions, get their advice, get their input, and see how do we draw the lines? How do we screen out illegitimate from legitimate? What's the effect of our decision going to be? And Judge Brasher, you mentioned that, you know, a lot of these cases are already dead because you can just go to tax court in a lot of instances, and the binding precedent of the tax court now is that these are invalid. I think that's important, but another important thing to keep in mind is my friend doesn't say that these are exempt from the APA. He says they're exempt from the notice and comment requirement. The APA still requires them to not be arbitrary and capricious. All of these notices badly, badly fail the arbitrary and capricious standard because they just announce what they're doing.
We don't have to get into that, though, do we?
No. If you have any concerns about saying that these violate notice and comment, just keep in mind that they definitely violate the APA for other reasons as well, and so will be invalidated anyway. Happy to answer any more questions, but otherwise I will sit down.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I want to speak briefly to the listed transaction notice that's at issue in this case, because I think that it speaks to how Congress views the IRS's issuance of listed transaction notices. When the IRS issued this particular notice designating certain conservation easements as listed transactions, and the transaction at issue here is one where a promoter tells someone in advance that they're going to be making $1 million investment to purchase a property, then turn around and have the potential to claim that a portion of what they just bought for $1 million is actually worth $2.5 million or more, and often more. Congress, the Senate Finance Committee, did a bipartisan investigation and issued a report in 2020 based on the data that was gathered pursuant to Notice 2017-10. 2 years later in 2022, this is 9 months plus post-Mann construction, Congress amends Section 170 of the Internal Revenue Code to eliminate syndicated conservation easements as an allowable deduction. It also, in doing so, directs the IRS to issue guidance about certain safe harbor extinguishment clause language to be used in leases for people to amend it, their existing leases for conservation easements, and directs the IRS to rely on and use Notice 2017-10 in issuing that guidance, which the IRS subsequently does in compliance with the congressional directive. That would be a very odd thing for Congress to tell the IRS to do if it didn't view these listing notices as being valid, if it thought that they were invalid. We understand the court's concern that this is going to create a situation where this could expand, this could encompass a lot of things that Congress really doesn't want to be outside the scope of the notice and comment process. We think that is a much more limited exception on its face than—
I just don't see how anything what you said, any of what you said has anything to do with telling us whether Congress has expressly exempted the service from the Administrative Procedures Act for these listed transactions.
Yes, Ron, and I'll point to two cases that I think best encapsulate our case, and maybe they're persuasive and maybe they aren't, but the Supreme Court in Dorsey talked about how if Congress enacts legislation or reenacts legislation without overriding an existing regulation, that serves as persuasive evidence that Congress believes that existing regulation is a correct implementation of its intent. And then the Asiana Airlines case from the DC Circuit, we would note that the regulation that we're relying on says that the IRS can use notice, regulation, or other published guidance. And what the court said in Asiana Airlines was that if they were to require notice and comment on top of the procedure that was spelled out, you would make it basically indistinguishable between notice and comment rulemaking and the procedure that was otherwise spelled out. And we think that would be the same case here, that you'd essentially be requiring notice and comment rulemaking. I see my time has expired.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.